If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, October 20th, 2022. The British Prime Minister Liz Truss resigns after 6 weeks in office and after her budget proposal led to economic market turmoil, and members of Parliament in her own Conservative Party started questioning her effectiveness. Coming up, we'll hear the Prime Minister's resignation speech, response from the opposition leader in Britain, Keir Starmer of the Labour Party, and we'll talk about this with C-SPAN's producer in London, Peter Knowles. President Joe Biden is in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, revisiting a bridge that collapsed earlier this year. He visited then as well to talk now about its quick rebuilding, thanks, he says, to the infrastructure spending law that he signed. Election day is 2.5 weeks away. We'll talk about the views of Latino voters towards Democrats and Republicans with Axios Latino race and justice reporter Russ Contreras. Attorney General Merrick Garland discussing the arrest of Russian nationals for trying to send U.S. military electronics and technology to the Russian military. Pentagon announces a new policy to pay for travel and expenses of U.S. troops seeking abortions who are based in states that restrict abortions. And retired Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer asked about the low approval ratings of the high court, telling an audience at Harvard University, "We as a country have gone through a lot of difficult periods, and despite these difficulties, the country has emerged. So naturally, I think it will emerge." And now to London, this from BBC News. Liz Truss has resigned as prime minister after 45 days in office marked by turmoil, triggering the second Tory leadership election in 4 months. Ms. Truss said her successor would be elected by next week after a rebellion of Tory MPs forced her to quit. Former Prime Minister Boris Johnson is among MPs said to be considering bids, but Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt has ruled himself out. Tory MPs revolted against Ms. Truss after a series of U-turns on her economic plan sapped her authority. That from BBC News. The Prime Minister gave a minute-and-a-half resignation announcement outside the Prime Minister's residence, 10 Downing Street.
I came into office at a time of great economic and international instability. Families and businesses were worried about how to pay their bills. Putin's illegal war in Ukraine threatens the security of our whole continent, and our country has been held back for too long by low economic growth. I was elected by the Conservative Party with a mandate to change this. We delivered on energy bills and on cutting national insurance. And we set out a vision for a low-tax, high-growth economy that would take advantage of the freedoms of Brexit. I recognise, though, given the situation, I cannot deliver the mandate on which I was elected by the Conservative Party. I have therefore spoken to His Majesty the King to notify him that I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party. This morning, I met the chairman of the 1922 committee, Sir Graham Brady. We've agreed that there will be a leadership election to be completed within the next week. This will ensure that we remain on a path to deliver our fiscal plans and maintain our country's economic stability and national security. I will remain as Prime Minister until a successor has been chosen. Thank you.
The British Prime Minister Liz Truss outside 10 Downing Street, the Prime Minister's residence in London, earlier today. General elections in Great Britain, and that's when all 650 members of the House of Commons face the voters, must be held at least every 5 years. And the next one under the schedule does not have to take place until January 2025. But the current opposition leader, Keir Starmer from the Labour Party, telling Sky News that given what's happened, a general election should be called sooner.
This is not just a soap opera at the top of the Tory party. It's doing huge damage to our economy and to the reputation of our country. And the public are paying with higher prices, with higher mortgages. So we can't have a revolving door of chaos. We can't have another experiment at the top of the Tory party. There is an alternative, and that's a stable Labour government. And the public are entitled to have their say. And that's why there should be a general election.
Some sympathy for Liz Truss, her time in office, pretty humiliating.
The damage that has been inflicted on the public through higher prices and mortgages is considerable. This is not a soap opera. These are real lives that are being impacted by the mess at the top of the Tory party. We've had this revolving door. We've had these experiments at the top of the Tory party. The public are entitled to choose between this utter chaos and a Labour Party which will stabilise the economy and have got a clear plan for growth, for living standards and for jobs of the future. We need a general election so the public can make their mind up about this utter chaos.
The British Labour Party leader Keir Starmer interviewed on Sky News. More on the resignation of the British Prime Minister Liz Truss of the Conservative Party. Joining us now from London is Peter Knowles, C-SPAN's Westminster producer. Thank you again for being with us. Before we talk policy, let's get the procedure down. What happens now to select a new prime minister?
We're going to find out later today. You'd think that we knew already, but the Conservative Party are meeting the group of MPs who decide on these things. It's called the 1922 Committee. They're meeting in a few hours' time to decide what the mechanism should be for electing a new leader, because they don't want it to be the same mechanism, the one that's in the rule book, as delivered Liz Truss, because in that case the MPs wanted one candidate, the members wanted a different candidate, and within a few weeks it all came unstuck. So they want to run things either under different rules or in a particular way, so that doesn't happen, and that the process happens really quickly. They want a new leader in place in Downing Street by next Friday. They don't want to hang around. But right now, we don't know. And what rules they decide on is going to have a very big impact on who wins.
The Prime Minister, in the resignation speech, said, "I was elected by the Conservative majority with a mandate," and she said, "given the situation, she is resigning." Who exactly lost trust in the Prime Minister?
The MPs did. They, from all sides of the party, not just the side that was sceptical right from the start, from all sides they lost trust. They didn't any longer believe she could deliver anything, really. It had all fallen apart very early on in her premiership, with a budget, which they called a mini-budget, though it was maxi in its effects, which was not sustainable. The markets hated it. It was a ton of unfunded borrowing in order to fund long-term tax cuts. And the markets hated it. And she never recovered from that, because in the last week, also, we've seen any number of U-turns and changes on those policies, in effect ditching practically the whole of that mini-budget, but it wasn't enough. Confidence had expired. And then there was something that the last time we spoke about this, you asked me, anything else going on in British politics? And I kind of struggled to think. And I said, well, fracking. There's the thing, fracking. Now, fracking's really important in this, because that's the extraction of gas from underground reserves. Because if you live in a populated, populous country where the gas is always going to be under where people live, then these small seismic shocks mean that your houses are experiencing constant little earthquakes. So understandably, householders are anxious about this, and MPs were anxious about it. So that was the other issue that was around yesterday. And the government so badly mishandled that issue and the way it was processed through Parliament that it ended up in utter chaos and with something like a fight, certainly a bit of a scuffle going on in the voting lobbies, and the whips absolutely furious with the government at the mess that they've made of it. And so there was a loss of belief that the government could handle anything competently. So it wasn't just about ideology and the budget having been too ideological and too far-reaching, but there was also a question about basic competence. And we put those two things together, and the MPs started doing exactly what they did with Boris Johnson, which was there were one or two resignations, but mainly it was about just people saying, we can't put up with this, we're not going to support it. And without the support of your MPs, you can't function as a prime minister. It's a given.
We're talking with Peter Knowles. He's been Westminster producer in London. In the last Prime Minister's questions with the Prime Minister Liz Truss on Wednesday, she said, I am a fighter. But how much did her personality play into this?
It did play in that she was never seen by even her strongest supporters as being a good public performer, a good public speaker. What they felt was that she was ideologically sound, very pro-free market, and that's what the membership liked, so she could win through on policy. But she was a poor public speaker, always. I mean, adequate at best. And so when the policies came unstuck and ceased to be supported and she had to U-turn on all the important policies, then what was left? What was left? And there was this fundamental constitutional problem. So where does her mandate come from to do something radically different from what Boris Johnson had been doing? Because the mandate was from the membership of the party. Well, that's a very, very small segment of the population. So people were surprised that she had taken it on herself to see that she really had a mandate for radical change, because nobody else could really see where that mandate came from. And she didn't have the public persona, the speaking ability that Boris Johnson certainly had. She didn't have that. And so it came unstuck.
The Prime Minister, Liz Truss, has now set the record for the shortest tenure of a British Prime Minister. And Theresa May and Boris Johnson, the previous two, they're in the top eight. What can we say?
It's fairly astonishing. We have got used to the idea that Prime Ministers might last up to 10 years or so. Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair got to the same sort of mark. But right now, there's a huge amount of humour going on about this on Twitter. In terms of longevity, one thing that's really caught the imagination is a very sarcastic remark that the Economist newspaper made, which is that they said that Liz Truss was in power in the sense of having authority for only 7 days before she undid that with the mini-budget, and that a supermarket lettuce has a longer shelf life. Well, rather naughtily, one of the popular newspapers, the Daily Star, picked up on that, and they set up a webcam feed with a picture of Liz Truss and, of course, a picture of a lettuce to see which would last the longer. And so today they're having enormous fun with the lettuce celebrating. And that's the sort of humour that's running around, the sort of quite black humour in some ways. And I noticed from another feed, I mean, let me just see if I can find it quickly. And it's somebody posting that it's someone making the point that their son had lived through two monarchs, three prime ministers, shortly three prime ministers, so many, four home secretaries, three foreign secretaries, and three chancellors. The list goes on. And their son is four months old. So that's the kind of humour that is doing the rounds and reflects a certain bewilderment, because our politics aren't usually quite this exciting. I think people will be quite happy for them to go back to a more normal level in the not too distant future.
Peter Knowles, C-SPAN's Westminster producer, joining us from London. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The White House putting out a statement from President Joe Biden on the resignation of the British Prime Minister. It reads, "The United States and the United Kingdom are strong allies and enduring friends, and that fact will never change. I thank Prime Minister Liz Truss for her partnership on a range of issues, including holding Russia accountable for its war against Ukraine. We will continue our close cooperation with the UK government as we work together to meet the global challenges our nations face." And President Biden asked about the resignation as he left the White House this morning.
Who did the right thing?
Prime Minister Truss.
Well, that's for her to decide. But look, she was a good partner on Russia and Ukraine, and the British are going to solve the problem. But she was a good partner.
Are you concerned about the spillover effects of the U.S. economy, given the political and economic?
No, I don't think they're that consequential.
President Biden on the White House lawn speaking with reporters. You could hear the helicopter Marine One revving up in the background. That last question about the economy, this from Reuters. UK's main stock indexes closed higher on Thursday after Liz Truss said she would resign as British Prime Minister, bringing a measure of relief to investors after her ill-fated tax plans unleashed turmoil in the financial markets. And in New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closing down today, 90 points. NASDAQ down 65, S&P 500 down 29. The U.S. Labor Department says the number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits fell last week by 12,000 to 214,000. It's low by historical standards, even while the economy is slowing down due in large part to historically high inflation. And this story from CNBC, Philadelphia Federal Reserve President Patrick Harker on Thursday said higher interest rates have done little to keep inflation in check, so more increases will be needed. "We are going to keep raising rates for a while," the central bank official said in remarks for a speech in New Jersey. "Given our frankly disappointing lack of progress on curtailing inflation, I expect we will be well above 4% by the end of the year." President Biden talking about the economy and specifically infrastructure spending today during a trip to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He went to the rebuilding site of the Fern Hollow Bridge. As Associated Press writes, the previous bridge became a symbol of the country's troubled infrastructure, collapsing into a ravine earlier this year just before President Joe Biden visited the city. AP story continues, a new span is being built and it could be finished by December. The White House is crediting the bipartisan infrastructure law championed by President Biden for the accelerated timeline. Here's the president today at the bridge.
"When I was here in January, I told the governor that we'd help and we'd be help rebuild this bridge behind us as fast as we possibly could. That day, the governor moved and signed an emergency order that let us move separate federal funding as quickly as possible to the project. The reason we could do that is because I just signed the infrastructure law a few months earlier. But had we waited for that money, it would have taken longer. The governor knew he could count on the new law to fund other projects to ensure the projects he already had started for infrastructure in the state would not be slowed down in the process. The result, Pennsylvania has been able to repair Fern Hollow Bridge in less than a year. And by Christmas, God willing, we'll be walking. I'm coming back to walk over to sucker. Although my staff said to me, you realize how many times you've been to Pittsburgh? I said, no, I said 19. I said, but Bobby, don't tell them in Scranton. Anyway, but it's being done in record time. Normally, you'd be looking at 2 to 5 years to build a bridge like this, literally. And the total project cost $25 million, fully paid for by the federal government.
President Biden at the Fern Hollow Bridge construction site, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The White House says that this bridge is just one of nearly 45,000 bridges in poor condition across the United States that need to be repaired or replaced. Which is a couple of weeks before Election Day. The president today also contrasting his party, the Democrats, and the members in Congress who voted for the $1 trillion plus infrastructure spending bill that he referenced, and most of the Republicans who did not.
Let's get something straight. We managed to get some Republicans to vote for this, 13 in the House and 19 in the Senate. And I'm truly grateful for them. I mean it sincerely. But a whole lot more voted against it, but are taking credit for it now. You know, you may have seen the news report on CNN describing Republicans who voted the infrastructure law after attacking me and Democrats for passing what they called socialism. Socialism. Well, now they're quietly and privately sending me letters. Not a joke. My administration asked for money. Ask for that money, talking about how important the project in their district are and for America. I've got to say, I was surprised to see there's so many socialists in the Republican caucus.
Among those joining President Biden today at the bridge in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, who is running for U.S. Senator. President Biden today also traveling with John Fetterman to Philadelphia for a campaign fundraiser. The nonpartisan Cook Political Report with Amy Walter rates the Pennsylvania Senate race as a toss-up. John Fetterman's Republican opponent is Dr. Mehmet Oz. Here's a new ad from John Fetterman and then some of an interview that Dr. Oz did this week with WTAJ-TV in Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
After my stroke, I was just grateful to see Giselle and our kids. Across Pennsylvania, I keep seeing families that don't have enough time to focus on each other. They're struggling, left behind. We got to make it easier for people to spend time with those they love. Politicians spend so much time fighting about the things that don't matter. I'll always be focused on what does. Access to healthcare, lower costs, good jobs, more time with those we love. I'm John Fetterman, and I approve this message.
Americans, Pennsylvanians in particular, are concerned about the economy, crime, and drugs. And drugs was the focus of our task force meeting today because so much of it is driven by failure at the federal level. But those kitchen table issues are what are plaguing Pennsylvanians and what they're going to ultimately vote on. All the other advertisements that we're seeing, all the other commotion you're seeing on television is about distraction. And it's all over the place with all kinds of campaigns. But the three issues that will determine this election are the economy, crime, and the border, specifically drug policy.
That's Dr. Mehmet Oz, an interview with a TV station in Johnstown, Pennsylvania from Wednesday, and an ad running in the Pennsylvania Senate race from the Democratic candidate John Fetterman. One of the governor's races this year, rated as a toss-up as well by the Cook Political Report, is in Arizona. The candidates are Republican Carrie Lake and Democrat Katie Hobbs. The election attracting some national attention. Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin, a Republican, campaigning with and for Carrie Lake in Tucson, Arizona, on Wednesday.
You got Katie Hobbs and Joe Biden together. And let me tell you, they are agents of chaos. Everything they touch gets worse. Inflation is running away, and what do? More runaway spending, driving up gas prices, making grocery prices run away from families, letting loose that silent thief of inflation that's stealing thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars from hardworking Arizonans, Virginians, and Americans. Crime's going through the roof. What do they want to do? Demean and demoralize law enforcement. We've got a wide open border that is an absolute national catastrophe. And what do they want to do? Invite more in. Friends, they are agents of chaos. And America knows it. It's no wonder she doesn't want to debate Carrie Lake. Come on. Let's go ahead and rehearse. What about inflation? Winner Carrie Lake. What about crime and standing up for law enforcement? Winner Carrie Lake. What about our border and keeping our nation secure and fentanyl out of the hands of innocent Americans? Winner Carrie Lake. No wonder she doesn't want to debate her.
Governor Glenn Youngkin, Republican from Virginia, in Tucson, Arizona, with the Arizona gubernatorial candidate, Republican Carrie Lake, on Wednesday. The Democratic nominee that was referenced, Katie Hobbs, was interviewed by PBS Arizona on Wednesday and asked about not wanting to debate Carrie Lake.
First question has to be, why are we doing this? Why are we not doing a debate?
Well, you know, I've said from the beginning that I want to be able to have a substantive conversation about the issues that Arizonans are facing, that I'm talking to them every day about on the campaign trail. And I think this is a great opportunity to do that, to make my case directly to the voters of how I'm hearing the issues and the plans we have to bring people together to solve these challenges. And I think that my opponent's activities over the last week, since this interview was announced, really underscore my case that she's only interested in a spotlight. She threw a tantrum outside of this building about this very interview. And that tantrum led to people in this building getting harassing and threatening phone calls and racist attacks. And that kind of behavior is the behavior of a high school bully. It's not the behavior of a leader. It's not the behavior of someone who deserves our vote for governor. And it shows that she doesn't have the temperament to lead. And so for me, this debate about debates is over. I am looking forward to not only this conversation, but I've been making the case to voters with reporters in different forums where there's the opportunity for a very in-depth dialogue about the issues.
Katie Hobbs, the Democratic nominee for Arizona governor, start of a half an hour interview with PBS Arizona on Wednesday. An article at Axios.com begins, a significant portion of U.S. Latinos say neither the Democratic Party nor the Republican Party represent or care about them. Joining us now on the phone from New Mexico is the reporter on that story, Russ Contreras, race and justice reporter for Axios Latino. Thank you so much for being with us. Tell us about your new poll.
Yeah, well, we did a poll in partnership with Telemundo and Ipsos, and we found a significant portion of Latinos say neither the Democratic Party nor the Republican Party represents or care about the issues. About 30% said neither party is moving the needle or does any good on immigration reform. And about 25% of respondents said neither party cares about Latinos. This comes at a time where historically about 65% of Latinos have been voting Democratic, 35% vote Republican. But the loyalties are right now stagnant. And it seems to be like some disillusionment with both parties. This could be trouble for the Democrats. And even though the Republicans are picking up, it means they're a swing vote. And in close elections, that could determine the control of the House of Representatives.
Well, specific states, specific districts, do you have some in mind where this could have greater influence?
Definitely in South Texas. This is an area that has been strongly blue for generations. Because the state of Texas redistrict some of those districts down there, in addition to some Latinos there, who mainly Mexican-Americans who have been swinging slightly more to the Republican Party, those races could flip and we could see a big change down there. If you change enough of those races and say you don't flip a seat out in southern New Mexico, where Yvette Harrell, the Republican, currently holds, you could see a significant portion of these seats flip. These races are going to be close, so it doesn't take a lot. But if you go down in South Texas, where you've seen a lot of Mexican-Americans become evangelical, then you can see these seats flip from blue to red.
In addition to immigration and border issues, are there other issues that come out in the poll, or did you ask them about why the Latino voters are feeling this way?
Yeah, I mean, overall, immigration has always ranked pretty low, maybe the fifth or sixth concern. It shot up to number three in this poll. It's probably because immigration has been in the news, of course, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis moved migrants out into Martha's Vineyard. But overall, the issues that Latinos consistently say they care about is the economy, inflation, and crime. These are two issues that Republicans poll well on. When you ask Latino voters which one of party does better on these issues, they consistently say Republicans have an edge on these, with the economy really strong. So if you see Republicans go into Hispanic areas and talk about jobs and business, that is resonating, especially with some of these swing Latino voters. And if you look in Nevada, some of the criticism that the Democrats are coming under is they're talking about abortion in Nevada. a state that has legalized prostitution, while Republicans are talking about the economy. That's why those races there for governor and Senate are very close.
We're talking with Russ Contreras from Axios Latino. What percentage of the American voting population is identified as Latino?
So roughly about 17 to 19% of the population identifies as Latino. The majority of them are Mexican-American, and they live in the American Southwest, parts of Chicago and the Midwest. They have historically been Democratic since John F. Kennedy ran for president in 1960, but those numbers have been going down. You have Republican in Florida, Cuban-Americans and Colombian-Americans lean more Republican. So it's really difficult when you lump them all into one group. It's hard to say they have same voting patterns when you're talking about fundamentally different groups with fundamentally different histories. What you can say, though, is that in these areas where there have been strong Democrats for years and you've had Democratic representatives both on the federal and state level, Republicans are making inroads by running Mexican-American candidates. Here in the state of New Mexico, the most Hispanic state in the nation, Republicans ran the highest number of Hispanics for state seats in its history. So finally, you're starting to see Republicans, if they see survival in the future, they're going to have to start talking to Latinos, mainly Mexican-Americans, not necessarily change their politics, but maybe change the way they discuss certain issues.
Russ Contreras is a race and justice reporter for Axios Latino. Find his stories at axios.com. And on Twitter, it's at Russ Contreras. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Washington Today continues in a minute.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts or on the C-SPAN Now video app. Some updates on the war in Ukraine. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby telling reporters today that Iranian troops are directly engaged on the ground in Crimea, supporting Russian drone attacks on Ukraine's infrastructure and civilians. John Kirby saying the information we have is that the Iranians have put trainers and tech support in Crimea, but it's the Russians who are doing the piloting. Crimea is a part of Ukraine that Russia has occupied since 2014 and claims it is now part of the Russian Federation. Ukraine's foreign minister, Dmitry Kuleba, says his country is starting to get deliveries of hundreds of mobile generators from European countries and private organizations to supply electricity after Russian missiles and armed drone attacks have knocked out at least 40% of Ukraine's power generating capacity. A top official with Ukraine's military general staff telling CNN that Russian forces' task number one is to hold the southern front line, and that Russians are digging in and sending more resources in hoping of holding off the Ukrainian forces pushing towards Kherson. The U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland speaking today about the arrest this week of two Russian nationals in, as NBC News reports it, a scheme to obtain sensitive U.S. military electronics and technology to provide it to the Russian defense sector. Attorney General Garland holding a news conference at the Justice Department with the visiting German Justice Minister.
Yesterday, the Justice Department unsealed an indictment in the Eastern District of New York against five Russian nationals and two oil traders charged with a global sanctions evasion and money laundering scheme that operated between January 2018 and September of this year. On Monday of this week, our partners in Germany arrested one of the defendants, Yuri Orkov. We are grateful for our partner's work. The indictment alleges that he and a co-conspirator sourced and purchased sensitive military and dual-use technologies from U.S. manufacturers and shipped them to Russia end users, including sanctioned companies that serviced Russia's defense sector. Those technologies included advanced semiconductors and microprocessors that are used in fighter aircraft, missile systems, smart munitions, radar, satellites, and other space-based military applications. Some of the same electronic components obtained through this criminal scheme have been found in Russian weapons platforms on the battlefield in Ukraine. I would like to express our gratitude to the German Ministries of Justice and Interior for their many invaluable acts of cooperation on this and our other cases related to sanctions evasion and Russian illicit finance.
Attorney General Merrick Garland at the Justice Department in Washington, D.C., sitting beside the German Justice Minister. In Iran, street protests in many cities, including the capital, Tehran, now in the 33rd consecutive day following the death of a 22-year-old woman in custody of the Iranian morality police, brought into custody for not wearing a headscarf in accordance with their interpretation of Islamic law. Some protesters chanting death to Khamenei, referring to the leader of Iran. And as Iran's violent crackdown on the anti-government protests also continue, calls for more sanctions of some kind. A question today to the U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price.
What is happening inside Iran? There's growing calls for Iran to be expelled from the U.N. Commission on the Status of Women, and an NGO in Switzerland that advises ECOSOC has drawn up a draft resolution, and they say that they have also presented it or proposed it to Secretary Blinken to present it to the council. Any thoughts on that?
We've made our position on this very clear. Iran's membership on the UN Commission on Women is contemptible. It is beyond inappropriate. It is outrageous. We've always been clear that some of the worst human rights abusers sit on certain UN commissions. I think this is, unfortunately, a good example of that. We have worked in the UN system beyond what we've done using our own authorities and with our own voice to condemn the violence that Iran is perpetrating against, in many cases, the brave women and girls who are doing nothing more but exercising rights that are as universal to them as they are to anyone else. We were one of 54 countries that issued a joint statement at the Human Rights Council calling for Iran to cease the disproportionate use of force against what are undeniably peaceful protesters. We don't believe Iran should sit on this commission. We're going to look at proposals to affect that outcome. We're going to take a close look at ideas, and we'll lend our support where it's appropriate for us to do so.
Ned Price is the State Department spokesman at his news conference today in Washington, D.C. From Voice of America, this article, the group Human Rights Iran said this week the death toll from the crackdown on the ongoing nationwide protests has so far reached at least 215, of which 27 were children. Iran's government has claimed that Mahsa Amini suffered a heart attack and was not mistreated. Her family said that she had no history of heart trouble and that her body bore bruises and other signs of beating. And meanwhile, citizens of 14 countries have been detained in connection with the protests in recent weeks in Iran, a media outlet close to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps reported. The report said those arrested include those from the United States, Russia, Austria, France, the United Kingdom, and Afghanistan. This is Washington Today. The Pentagon announcing today that the U.S. government will fund travel and expenses for troops and their dependents who seek abortions but are based in states where abortion is restricted. The Pentagon Press Secretary Pat Ryder saying that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin signed the order after a policy review following the Supreme Court's overturning earlier this year of the Roe v. Wade decision that had legalized abortion.
Today, Secretary Austin signed a memo directing the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness to oversee implementation of a number of initiatives designed to ensure reproductive health care access for our service members and their family members, and to bring clarity to DOD policies in the wake of the Supreme Court decision in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. The memo will be available on our defense.gov website and underscores the Secretary's top priority of taking care of our people and ensuring their health and well-being. As evidenced by the numerous operations the U.S. military conducts and supports around the world on any given day, our service members and their families are our key warfighting advantage and our greatest source of strength. It is well understood by those wearing the uniform of our nation's armed forces that frequent and sometimes unpredictable travel or moves are often required to meet operational training or staffing requirements. As Secretary Austin's memo highlights, such moves should not limit their access to reproductive health care. Following the Supreme Court's decision, Secretary Austin and other DOD and service leaders received significant feedback from many service members about the complexity and uncertainty they now face in accessing reproductive health care, to include abortion services. The decision also raised questions about potential legal and financial risks for DOD health care providers as they carry out their lawful federal duties. The practical effect of the recent changes is that service members may be forced to travel greater distances, take more time off work, and pay more out-of-pocket expenses to access reproductive health care, all of which have readiness, recruiting, and retention implications for America's armed forces.
The Pentagon Press Secretary, General Pat Ryder, in the Pentagon briefing room. Politico explains that under current law, most abortions cannot be performed at military medical facilities, and service members' TRICARE health insurance does not cover the cost of obtaining the procedure privately. And the Hyde Amendment of 1976 prohibits the use of federal dollars for abortion unless the life of the mother is in danger. The new policy will allow service members and dependents who must travel to access reproductive care to request travel allowances and an administrative absence from their normal duty station so they don't need to take leave. Former Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, who was a strong dissenting vote in the Dobbs abortion decision earlier this year, one of his last decisions before his retirement, on Wednesday spoke at the Harvard University Institute of Politics in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and was asked about the American public's views about the Supreme Court.
When John Roberts became Chief Justice in 2005, and since then, it seems like a core of his mission was to preserve, protect, and defend not just that, but the court itself as an institution. Mm-hmm. Right now, you have seen it's 25% of people approve of the court. Has he failed?
No, because we don't know what'll happen. No, I mean, I used to work for Senator Kennedy, and one of the things he liked to say was the country goes like this, you know? It goes like this. There have been some terrible situations in the United States of America. I mean, this Congress, whom everybody criticizes, is the moment. Remember, Bully Brooks beating up Senator Sumter, from this state, the abolitionist. And a lot of that's just on the floor of the Congress. I mean, we have gone through slavery. We have gone through Jim Crow. We have gone through all kinds of things. And you're not even old enough to remember what this was like in Vietnam, this place here. If we were back when I was starting to teach, I probably wouldn't have even been allowed to speak here, because the building hadn't been built yet. In any case, you know, there were all kinds of things going on, and they weren't all good. And with Archie Cox, do you mind if I digress a little bit?
No.
I have been doing nothing but that to avoid your very penetrating question. But the Archie Cox and I had to spend the night at Widener Library, you know, because the students said they're going to burn it down as a protest against Vietnam. And I'd said, you know, I didn't start the Vietnam War. You know, I'm just teaching here as an assistant professor. And moreover, I don't even like the Vietnam War. I think it's terrible. That makes no difference. Okay, but they didn't burn down Widener, but they might have done. Instead, all right, you understand what I'm saying. I'm saying we've gone through a lot of difficult periods. And despite the difficulties, the country has emerged. So naturally, I think it will emerge. And what I've seen for the last 30 years, and more than that really, because it's true of the First Circuit too, this document does help to hold people together. It does. Millions of people have no idea what's in it, but they do know it helps hold us together. 331 million people. And my mother used to say that in San Francisco. She said there's every race, every religion, every point of view. And she said there's no point of view so crazy that there isn't somebody in this country who doesn't hold it. Okay? But she said they all live in Los Angeles, so don't worry about it. You understand it. And what I'd see, the most amazing thing to me that I saw on day one down in that court, and the last day ever, in front of this court, people of all different points of view have come together to try to resolve their disputes under law. Now, maybe that doesn't move you as much as it moves me, but it moves me a lot.
Retired Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, who is now a Harvard Law School professor, returning to that school, as he mentioned. He was an assistant professor back in the 60s, speaking Wednesday night at the Harvard Institute of Politics in Cambridge. The question coming from one of the moderators, Nancy Gibbs, director of the Kennedy School of Government's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy. With Stephen Breyer's retirement, he is now one of four living retired Supreme Court justices. The others are Sandra Day O'Connor, David Souter, and Anthony Kennedy. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. You can subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.